The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.
Well, hey there, everyone. Welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the worlds of books and film and streaming TV, and we are a product of Sea of Reeds Media, which also owns two independent bookstores in New Jersey, the Bookhouse in Millburn and the Bookhouse in Long Branch. You should patronize both those stores if you're in New Jersey, and you can always credit those bookstores if you go to bookshop.org and you purchase a book there. You can give a percentage of your proceeds to our bookstores. So that's always something that we encourage. But first, we're going to have a podcast. We're going to have our weekly show here, and we're going to talk about some issues not related to books this week that are very, very important. My friend Richard Rushfield, who is a columnist for and a founding light of The Ankler, a leading newsletter in Hollywood, is going to be here to talk about some very important issues, mostly regarding people talking and texting and singing during movies. It is unacceptable, and we stand firmly against that at Book and Film Globe, and Richard is a warrior in this fight. He will be here to speak with me about that. I'm also going to talk to my friend Sherry Flanders, a writer and comedian in Chicago, about Breath of Fire, which is a documentary series on Max about Kundalini yoga and the evils it has inflicted upon the world. And finally, we're going to speak with contributor Omar Gayaga about A Man on the Inside, a kind of syrupy, maudlin, over-sentimentalized show about a nursing home in San Francisco, stars Ted Danson. It has some things to offer it, but it also has some problems, and Omar and I are going to pick over that show, maybe more than it deserves, but we give pop culture topics a lot of attention here at Book and Film Globe, and that is what makes us so great. But first, Richard Rushfield will be here, and we're going to make sure that people never talk in movies again. There are a lot of important issues in the world that need to be addressed. There are many problems that need to be corrected. But at Book and Film Globe, there is no more pressing problem than people being rude while attending movies. Rude movie theater audiences is a plague that has been visited upon society in recent years and has gotten worse. And I have recruited our friend and contributor to The Ankler, one of the founding lights of The Ankler, one of Hollywood's greatest cultural products, newsletters. Richard Rushfield is here. And I don't know of anyone other than me who is more upset about this trend. Hello, Richard.
Hello. Thank you for having me. Thank you for devoting attention to this this plague.
It's one of the few things I actually care about in this world. So, I would talk about it every week if I could. So there's a couple of things we need to discuss, Richard. So obviously this issue has been brought to the forefront by the release of Wicked Part One, which has theater kids desiring to sing along to their favorite mediocre songs. let's face it, there's a couple of bangers, but most of the music's pretty bad. And so Cynthia Erivo, the star of Wicked Part One, released a statement and said it was okay for people to sing along in movies. Mm.
Is it okay for her to personally pay me back for my tickets and my time that I wasted having her minions annoy me?
I mean, I think that there is a case to be made in court.
I will say this, though. I will say doing sing-along, it's a plague. It should be shot down, but it's of a lesser degree of plague because at least they're doing something in tandem with the screen, whereas most of the disturbances in theaters are just ignoring the screen entirely and having your own separate experience on TikTok or whatever.
Right. Well, there is like a, you know, and there are sing-along showings. Like I remember many years ago going to one of the early iterations of these, like the in Chicago, used to have an annual sing-along to The Sound of Music.
And truth be told, if I knew the music from Wicked and liked it myself, I would probably be less annoyed.
Possibly. I mean, but there again, I don't see how it would be possible to really sing along to Wicked, because most of the songs are not that good, and the ones that are good are very hard to sing along to, whereas everyone can kind of hum along to My Favorite Things, you know.
It's very exactly. And, well, they should have done this for West Side Story. Would have been everyone could have been doing Officer Krupke together, and that I would have approved of that.
It would have been fun for you. So Cynthia Erivo put out the statement, and then also The Rock, Dwayne The Rock Johnson, who himself can't sing, put out a statement saying that people should be able to sing along to Moana too if they want to, even which would be almost impossible given that no one has ever heard the songs from Moana 2 before.
Yeah, and from what I hear, they're unsingable. Have these folks heard of the Rocky Picture Show?
Horror Picture Show, yeah.
Rocky Horror Picture Show, yeah. That, I mean, that exists, and they can go to that, and they have a place that services this craving for them. The Rocky Horror Picture Show has been very good. It's sort of staying within its cinemas at its showing times and not kind of bursting in on other shows and other gentlefolk attempting to enjoy their evening out.
Well, okay, you're right, though. The sing-along is a different order of business than this plague of interruptions. You probably saw that post that this woman put up, or person put up, I don't know if they were a woman, posting her screenshot, their screenshot of the opening credits of Wicked, right?
I did not see this, actually, so...
Saying share your... It was like, share your screenshots of Wicked. And so this was obviously someone who was at a screening of Wicked.
Yeah, and encouraging people to take pictures in the theater.
Of the opening credits that they will be able to probably...
Which, by the way, is illegal. That's piracy. So she should be... So we have the law on our side to have them arrested right there.
Yeah. Well, we do. I mean, I think that's the thing is we do have the law. We have the law on our side about people taking screenshots of movies, you know, and especially with like, you know, I publish screenshots of movies all the time, but I pull them. They're called publicity stills. And I pull them from the official websites of the films, then post them because that is legal because they are released.
And these people should know with certainly big blockbuster movies. Every one of those screenshots, that screen is secretly watermarked, and we can find you with them.
Is that true?
Yes,
that
it is. True? Yeah. So
every film has a watermark just running throughout it.
So when it's posted on the Bulgarian piracy site, they look at it and they know the cinema and the time of the showing, and right. They can look back at security cam footage and at that screening and find the people.
So this is a problem, but is a problem that law enforcement, if they chose to devote their resources to it, could solve. But a problem that law enforcement cannot solve are people talking during movies, texting during movies.
Well, what we're saying here is if they do that, then law enforcement has the technology at their disposal to go after the people who are talking in the movies, who have self-identified themselves. If they want to fight real crime instead of just being the woke pronoun enforcement,
right? Or trying to chase down people, shipping fentanyl into the United States.
Yeah,
they could solve some real problems. But the problem is like there's not necessarily everyone who's posting a screenshot is catchable, because you know some people just kind of like to sit there and scroll Instagram while they're watching movies. And I'll admit, like if I'm at the Alamo Drafthouse, where I see like 95% of my movies, has a very strict policy about this, which is one of the reasons why I like to go there, even though sometimes I'm forced to sit next to someone who is noisily scraping the bottom of his chicken Caesar salad bowl with a fork. You know, that is it's a trade-off, but they enforce it. But I thought, I'll admit that like occasionally if I'm in like sitting row 3, seat 10, like I always do, and it's a like middle of the day showing and there's one other person in the theater and then they're in the back of the theater and I'm bored, I'll look at my phone to check the time.
Oh my Jesus Christ. Wow.
Is that okay? If it's not going to bother anyone and I'm bored and I want to get the hell out of there, sometimes I'll look at them. Sometimes I'll just go to the bathroom and look at my phone, like on the way back for the bathroom. That's too.
I mean, there's a There's a device you can use
called a watch.
That they have these inventions called watches where you can.
But I'm not sitting there like checking my email or people scrolling TikTok. I've seen people sitting there scrolling TikTok while watching a movie.
So if we can mobilize, you know, a kind of vigilante system here, I think this is a good thing. When I've been in a theater. To the horror of my family, when I see people looking at their phone and talking and sharing at it, I sort of light up because I know I'm going to be saying something. And I, even if things go well, might have the chance to get that person removed from the theater and teach them a real lesson. And that's a real public service I've done then. So
you've done that. How many times have you had people kicked out of movie theaters?
You know, not. I mean, it's not every day. It's not.
It's not every week. Not even every week.
What's your number, Neil?
About a half dozen.
Significantly more than that, shall we say?
Well, I don't know. I don't know how long my wife would stay married to me if I did it every time I went to the movies.
My wife does not go to many movies with me anymore. And my children, when they notice someone on their phone and see that look in my eye, they start pleading immediately. Please, please don't do it. Please don't. And my son is now big enough to actually hurt me during the movie. So
yeah. I've been to like one movie with my son in the last 5 years. I think he would probably stab me through the heart with a straw, you know, using all his force, all his might. Yeah, it's kind of like when my dad used to complain about the service in a restaurant.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and we would all like shrink into little balls, knowing what was coming.
Yeah, as I've explained to my children. Where all the inputs of your life are shut off and you can completely absorb yourself in a narrative experience and give yourself over to the story of someone else. And this is a religious experience to leave your own existence for a short amount of time. And we as society are losing the ability to do this. And
while still eating Junior Mints.
Exactly. And what sitting in very comfortable chairs, you know, you don't have to climb Kilimanjaro to do this. Your recliners, you can have a blanket over you even.
Yeah, you can do it. You can sit there with your legs crossed. There's lots of ways to do it that are comfortable and non-intrusive. And I feel like these are important points to make because, you know, despite all predictions to the contrary, movies are not going away. I mean, we just had the biggest box office Thanksgiving in history. This weekend,
yeah. I'm working on trying to get a good combined name for the
three movies
because now we have three movies, so we can't just so you have Moana, Gladiator, and what's
Wicked
and Wicked. So
I'm looking forward to the Christmas with a baby girl and Nosferatu. I've already seen people calling it Baby Ratu. It's not going to hit the same way.
Will we ever revisit the heights of Barbenheimer?
Barbenheimer was, you know, we'll never get there, but we did have a Barbenheimer style box office weekend. And so it's significant because people are still going to some movies. They're not the sort of middle range directed by Clint Eastwood movie may not be getting releases in theaters, but they're clearly movie theaters are not dying if we're having blockbusters like this. So I think it's up to you and me, Richard. I think it's going to be like a Space Cowboys, like that movie Space Cowboys with the old astronauts.
Yeah,
will be just like old men attempting to stop people from misbehaving in movie theaters.
Yeah, I mean, I wish we had some kind of legal standing, and we could deputize people. I mean, I some sort of badge and uniform that we could wear to the theaters would be
helpful. Well, I'm gonna tag Elon Musk on X, and maybe he can make that happen. Maybe he could like bring some robots, androids, into theaters.
Robots would help certainly. At the New Beverly Theater where I went this weekend, the manager makes a very heartfelt explanation about this before each screening, and he asks that the audience alert him if there are any incidences of cell phone use so that he may come and dispense justice, which I thought was a noble sentiment.
Yes. Well, Richard Rushfield, I hereby deputize you to dispense justice at movie theaters all over the United States. May your vigilante campaign be successful, and the next generation, they need to learn, and we're going to teach them. So thank you for stopping by today to talk about this most important issue.
And bless you and the important work you're doing, bringing attention to these issues here.
Thank you, sir. All right. Talk to you soon.
I never understood why there weren't more questions about a white woman in a turban.
Inhale.
My teacher, Yogi Bhajan, gave every ounce of his day and night to delivering this canon of teachings. Much like Yogi Bhajan, Guru Jagat had everyone under her spell.
Those who hold the powers of these teachings will rule the earth for 5,000 years.
Regular listeners of this program would have no way of knowing that I am a yoga enthusiast. I've written 3 books about yoga. I've been practicing yoga for 20 years, and I avidly and knowledgeably consume all yoga content that comes across my feed. And there was recently a very interesting and compelling and really kind of tragic documentary on HBO Max called Breath of Fire, about the world of Kundalini yoga, which is a kind of yoga that I'm not particularly interested in, but I'm certainly familiar with. So I thought in order to talk about Breath of Fire, I would bring in my friend and collaborator on certain matters, Sherry Flanders. And she, hello, Sherry. So Sherry, for those of you who may not know her, is a writer and a film critic and a theater critic and an actor and a comedian based in Chicago and a yoga practitioner. So you watched it.
I did.
Yeah. What a saga.
Oh, my God. Wow. It was a lot. I'm not nearly as committed of a yoga practitioner as you, but I have done some yoga. I am a person with gym rat tendencies. And so I love to sweat. I like to work out. And so after I ran the marathon the first time, I was like, you know what? I should do some yoga and become more flexible and do some strength training because that was never my thing. And that was kind of my entry point into yoga. And it was mostly like the hatha and the vinyasa and those sorts of things. But I did come across an instructor at one point who, you know, spoke very highly of Kundalini. So it was always on my radar. I was like, oh, one day maybe I'll try that if I get around to it. And I never did. And then I saw this and there's so much going on.
Man, aren't you grateful you never got involved in that shit. For those of you who don't know, Kundalini yoga, and the documentary goes into very great detail about this, came to the United States in the late 1960s in the form of a man named Yogi Bhajan, who apparently was an Indian customs agent who got someone pregnant and then moved here. And
As you do.
And he moved to the United States and used the fact that he was an Indian man with a beard who wore a turban to use that as a way to convince naive young spiritual boomer seekers that he was a yoga guru. And he invented something called Kundalini yoga. And so Breath of Fire, which the documentary is partly about the birth of Kundalini yoga, that's about, and Yogi Bhajan. And the other, I would say its major focus is a modern story about a young woman named Katie Griggs, or as she became known as Guru Jagat, who is a modern sort of Instagram influencer who took the precepts of Kundalini yoga and turned them into a sort of a motivational cult. Would you say that's accurate, Sherry?
I would say that is 100% accurate. And it was really fascinating to me. I really had to like get in touch with my emotions watching this, because I think when I watch these kinds of like cult stories, I think there's the part of me that wants to distance myself from it. Like I could never, and I'd move into my most judgmental place. But when you learn the story of Katie Griggs or Guru Jagat, it's really sad because she was someone who was a victim, who was taken advantage of and then proceeded to take advantage of others. And so it was just this cycle of re-victimization and abuse. And that's just really tragic.
It is. Although I will say this, there is a difference. There is a vast difference between the kinds of abuses that Yogi Bhajan inflicted on his followers and the kinds of abuse that Guru Jagat inflicted on her followers. Her sins were mostly of mild fraud She was a bad boss, materialistic, I guess. You know, she took money from rich followers and used it to, you know, buy expensive clothes and travel and spread her reputation. But Yogi Bhajan was a serial sexual abuser, an abuser of children, truly evil, sinister man, who was a genuine cult leader along the lines of Jim Jones in some ways, you know. Whereas I don't think Katie Griggs, there are people who were her followers who are like, yeah, she was a bitch to me, you know, she was bad, but she also helped me escape from an abusive relationship, and she was very encouraging and very positive. She's human, I guess. She's not a monster. Well, and the fact that, like, half the documentary, I feel like, is interviewing her mother.
Yes. Oh, her poor mom. I think one of the things that I wanted more from this documentary, because for me, one of my biggest things is just like, how? And there were a lot of her followers that they spoke to. I really had a disconnect with folk saying, you know, I was at a rough spot in my life. I was seeking, I was looking for spiritual fulfillment. And then I landed upon this person who was an Instagram personality and very materialistic. I mean, it just like, there was this huge disconnect where I was like, it was kind of like saying, I would like to join a church and I would like it to be run by Kim Kardashian. Like, that is kind of what they all kept saying. So it was like the prosperity gospel. It was not examined more. And I really wanted them to drill down on that.
Look, it's Los Angeles, first of all. You gotta understand.
I'm from Indiana. I'm a humble Midwestern girl.
Yeah, no, I know. I lived in LA. I saw this phenomenon happen over and over again. Well, there's a couple of things going on here. One, this is a 4-hour long show that could easily have been 2 hours.
Oh, yes.
They were using the same footage over and over again. It needed some editing. It would have been better. It was still good, but it would have been better if it had been tighter.
Agreed.
Just as a piece of art.
Yes.
That said, I mean, as someone who has done a lot of yoga and seen a lot of people get sucked into a lot of different kinds of yoga, the thing it didn't get across is you're sitting there on the mat. You're doing all these like intense breath exercises, all this intense physicality. You're in a room with a lot of people, and the energy is vibrating very intensely. And yoga is a very powerful thing, right? So if you're doing it, you know that feeling, that sort of tingly feeling you get when you're laying in Shavasana, right?
Yeah, you're getting the endorphins. You're getting, like, you know, as a runner, you get the runner's high. You know, breath of fire is basically like you're hyperventilating.
Pretty much.
Put all that and a bunch of people in a room, some good vibes, probably a lot of weed. Yeah.
I mean, especially in LA, yeah, definitely. There's definitely a lot of weed going on. And
there's a vibe happening.
There's a vibe. And, you know, a lot of times people who are attracted to yoga are people who are in a sensitive place or are feeling or are vulnerable, yes, or are coming out of some sort of bad relationship. And so what happens is, the person who gives you that feeling, you become attached. You develop an attachment to them.
Trauma bonding. They're on a pedestal.
Yeah. And you become, like, you literally, the whole point of yoga is to practice not detachment, but non-attachment.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times the teachers, either they don't understand that themselves or they're using it for various exploitative purposes. And so people become attached. And Guru Jagat was a very charismatic woman. I mean, I would have taken one look at that class and walked right out the door and gone to get a Jamba Juice or something. Like, I am not going to be wearing a turban.
No, the turbans and then the forehead beads, I would have been like, absolutely not.
Well, yeah, but also, you know, the 45 minutes of lecture before you get to talking, before you get to moving, I'm like, no, you get in there, the teacher says, nice to see you all. Maybe introduce a theme for a minute, and then you get to
I'm like, when are we going to do a sun salutation?
Exactly. When does the meditating start, or do I have to sit here and listen to you talk about all the products that you want me to buy?
Exactly.
But again, like, you know, it's a pyramid scheme, and she got people high one way or another, and they became devoted to her because she made them feel good.
Yeah, I think it was especially poignant watching the mom and also the best friend. You know, for as close as she was to all of her followers and as much as she meant to them, she had pulled so far away, you know, from the people who knew her the best, the people that she had, you know, had her entire formative years with. It was illuminating to see that her friend didn't even recognize that she was actually a cult leader. She was like, well, I knew kind of she was really popular in yoga and was maybe an influencer, but she didn't really it wasn't until after she, spoiler alert, after she passed.
After she passed away, which is, you know, and you get the sense too that like, it's possible that Katie might have snapped out of it.
It's possible. She might be on the lam.
You don't know. I mean, I will say she went very mad during COVID, as many of us did. But she was like, you know, what do they call it? It's conspirituality. She was talking about, you know, 5G microchips in the vaccines, interviewing a Holocaust denier on her podcast. Like, she wasn't just saying reopen the schools. You know, she was like, she went way down the rabbit hole and lost her mind. But I felt sorry for her. Whereas Yogi Bhajan, I would love to go back in time and stop him.
He was a horrible person. And I think there was another thing I would have liked to have seen is a little bit of the examination and of how the fetishizing of of another culture by Americans led to putting a horrible person on a pedestal. Because, you know, he kept saying, yes, this was a secret yoga form. And like, no one else was like, let me just ask someone else.
That was the 60s and 70s. And we just knew less about yoga than we do now. But if you want to see how that can happen, there's an excellent documentary about Bikram yoga, which is, you know, much more narratively coherent. And it's only about one person, but it's a similar type thing. And he was a monster. And there was also, you know, of course, the legendary Netflix documentary Wild Wild Country,
which I love so much.
That's a great series, not so much about yoga, but it is about how Indian spiritual leaders can trick Westerners into believing their bullshit.
And I think that says something about like us as Americans, where I think like it's not our first rodeo with cults. We've had a lot of them and we keep falling for it. So I think there's something about us and maybe the idea that seeking this higher plane, there might be a little naivete in that, and there might be a little folly in that, and that we just keep kind of following these lemmings off the cliff.
But it's not just Americans, Sherry. Like
100%.
If you look at the history of yoga in India, there is a long tradition of false gurus using the powers of yoga. There are many parables about this, of using the powers of yoga to manipulate people for their own evil ends. So the story of Guru Jagat is just a very modern Instagram influencer iteration of the age-old story. And I'm always wary. Like I practice yoga very quietly in my room with you know, videos, and I have no guru anymore. I am my own guru. But I remember when I first got started and sort of first fell in love with it, I could see how it could happen. You know, you could get sucked in.
And I think same for me. I was more on the fitness end of it. And, you know, I would occasionally intersect with the more spiritual end of it. But as someone who is not particularly religious or spiritual or anything, I have always felt not necessarily at home in those spaces, which I think is made a little bit of a firewall for me getting too far into anything like that.
Yeah, they're not going to get you because a fitness person gets all the benefits, but is able to, you know, save their money and not, you know, fall prey to the woo-woo. And, you know,
I'm like, I got three crystals. I'm good. I don't need any more.
Yeah. You know, one for luck, one for creativity.
One because it's cute.
Yeah, that's all you need. All right. Well, Sherry, thank you so much for stopping by the podcast dome to talk about.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Now, real quick, let's do the breath of fire. But we'll do it off. Yeah. We're going to do it off a tape because nobody wants to hear us breathing in.
No, ASMR, something weird. No, let's not.
Absolutely not. All right. Thank you very much.
Bye.
When mom was alive, they lived this big, full life. I'm giving you a challenge. Find something that excites you.
It's a good challenge. I accept.
Investigative assistant.
You would pretend to be a new resident.
You're interested in a tour?
We are. And be my source.
A man on the inside. I'm in.
The number one show program on Netflix, surpassing even Hot Frosty, over Thanksgiving weekend was the Ted Danson sitcom, I guess you call it a sitcom, set in a San Francisco nursing home, and it's called A Man on the Inside, and it's a new show from Michael Schur, who created The Good Place, among other popular network sitcoms. And Omar Gallagher, who is very well-versed in the world of comedy, wrote about it for us for Book and Film Globe, and he's here to talk to me about it. Hello, Omar.
Hey, Neil. How are you doing?
Good. Yeah, that's that place that Ted Danson pretends to check into, I guess, in A Man on the Inside. It's a lot nicer than what most of us are going to get.
Yeah, it's in San Francisco. It's like, it's ethical. Everyone's treated nicely and with respect. There's no elder abuse or financial fraud that we can see. It was kind of like much like The Afterlife was a little bit too good to be true in The Good Place. This one feels a little bit too good to be true. And of course, all the residents are, you know, like adorable and wonderful, and you know, people you would want to hang out with. No one's screaming.
Sane and healthy, and you know, yeah, there are some old people who die, but it happens off screen. You don't see. You know, everyone seems to, you know, they seem to be still having sex, and they all seem to have lots of money.
There is exactly one old coot, and he actually turns out to be a nice guy in the end. So like, even that guy, you know, has a change of heart.
Yeah, you know, and I mean, I had a personal connection to this. You know, we had to move my father into one of these places in Arizona, and he lasted there a month until he passed away. And I'm not going to get into the story too much, but it was close-ish. But this place felt more like a hotel. It didn't feel real, and that's I think the major problem with A Man on the Inside. Well, there's that, and then the whole premise is just so ridiculous, right?
Yeah. I mean, well, at first it works. I mean, it's a high concept. It's you know, it's someone being sent in to be a spy, you know, working with a private investigator to investigate a very low stakes crime, which is someone's necklace was stolen, an old woman's necklace was stolen. And the son, played by Evan Mark Jackson, I believe, from The Good Place, he just wants the necklace back. And that's the whole, you know, it seems like a lot of money to spend to get one necklace back, but apparently he has the resources to do that. So he hires them. He's supposed to go in for 30 days to investigate this. But of course, in the course of him staying there, he finds a community. He finds people he likes. He finds people, he kind of starts developing hobbies and kind of gets acclimated to the environment, to the point where there's that line of like, Donnie Brasco comes into the conversation of like, you know, is he getting too close to these sources? Is he getting too close to these people he's investigating? But it's all very benign in the end. And really where the show started to sag for me around the middle was where it really started to focus on his wife's death after she'd been suffering from dementia, and his kind of trauma around that of like not wanting.
Right. He's a widower.
Ted
Danson is a widower. And, you know, it is Ted Danson. So he's this impossibly handsome, sophisticated widower who lives in a beautiful mid-century modern home in Oakland that's perfectly kept and perfectly preserved. And it's just the whole thing just, again, well, I think it's part of the problem with Hollywood productions in general is like there's just no sense of how ordinary people actually live and what life is like for regular people. The show is based on a documentary called The Mole, which came out sort of during, I guess, the COVID era. It is available on streaming, but that's more of a fraud, you know, in the nursing home industry, which is the actual problem, not like the star of the ocean jewelry getting stolen from some rich old lady.
Yeah, it feels like you know, it's a great start. Like, I mean, I think the show starts off really strongly, and you know, and there's a lot of humor around him kind of becoming a spy. You know, like I'm gonna wear this pocket square when I'm in spy mode. You know, like that. You know, and it's Ted Danson doing it, so it's, you know, absolutely charming, absolutely pro level. You know, Ted Dansoning in this show, but then I feel like it really just sags in the middle. I feel like it really hits this point where it's kind of a sad com.
A sad com, you said?
A sad com, yeah. It becomes more sad than comedic. And we have lots of sad coms out there. You know, we have lots of, you know, these kind of wistful comedies or comedies that are kind of dealing in depression. And when it's done at a very high level, really well, you have something like Reservation Dogs, which is, I would say, a sad com, but done at an incredibly high, you know, level. And then you have something that's a little saggier like this, where it just feels a little bit too gentle, too nice. You know, which would be fine if we had the sort of joke density that you have in The Good Place or Parks and Recreation, where there's enough jokes and humor and set pieces to carry it along. By the end, it sort of gives up on that. I feel like the humor just completely bleeds out of it toward the end, where there's just not any more jokes. It just feels like it's just character moments and bonding. And you know you're in trouble when, like, on the finale, like, you know, it's a wistful Tom Petty song over a montage of going through your dead relatives' old things. It's like, oh God, this is, where are we?
As opposed to what it's actually like, which is that you haul as many boxes as you can to the Salvation Army and dump them on the sidewalk, which is what happened when my parents passed away. It was extremely unsentimental, even if I wanted it to be. It, just reality wouldn't allow that to happen. There are a couple of cultural comparisons I wanted to make to this show. One, of course, is I feel like just the fact that it's set in this place, in a building, you have to compare it to Only Murders in the Building, which is one of the most successful streaming shows of all time, but which refuses to give up its absurd premise, right? Like, which is just wafted along in this wave of just, like, you know, manic comedic energy from its stars and its guest star and its amazing guest stars. I mean, that's a much higher end show than this. This is a smaller thing.
Yeah. Only Murders in the Building never forgets that it's a comedy first. Like, it never forgets to lay out jokes, to give Steve Martin and Martin Short bits, you know, to do, and Selena Gomez, like, and they have great chemistry together. I think in this one, really, it's Ted Danson. the co-stars in the show are fine. They're great, but no one is doing, you know, the comedy work that Ted Danson is doing. So there's no one to really, for him to bounce off of the way, you know, like a Steve Martin and Martin Short would together. Like, there's no strong comedic ensemble around Ted Danson. Everyone is basically playing it straight, except for him.
Right. And Ted Danson is one of the great sitcom actors, if not the greatest sitcom actor of all time, but he needs co-stars.
Yeah. Stephanie Beatrice from Brooklyn Nine-Nine is in the show, but she's not funny. It's not a comedic role.
Yeah, she's very boring. And he's a daughter character who I found her sort of home life in Sacramento with their triplets. It didn't have a lot of resonance, and it wasn't really related to the rest of the show. So I just didn't like it. But I will say, I don't know if you had a chance to watch a recent movie that is now streaming on Hulu called Thelma.
No, but I hear it's fantastic. It's on my list. Yeah.
Yeah, you should definitely watch Thelma, because that stars June Squibb in a performance that may actually eke an Oscar nomination out of it, although there's going to be a lot of competition this year. But she plays a 93-year-old woman who, she does not live in a home, but her friend, her only surviving friend, played by Richard Roundtree, of all people, does live in a home. And the home that they depict him living in is much more realistic. You know, they're nice and they try, but, you know, he has a roommate. The people feel like actual elderly people. A lot of them are living in squalor. There's a lot of senility, and they have a lot of physical problems that the characters in A Man on the Inside don't have. And the plot, the plot's kind of ridiculous, but, like, June Squibb's character looks for revenge on some phone scammers who rip her off of $10,000. A somewhat unrealistic the way it plays out, but the details about what it's like to be elderly are so good that you can kind of forgive some of the plot contrivances. And I just feel like that's what a Man on the Inside is lacking.
Yeah, the characterizations of the residents felt very surfacey. It felt very like types, not actual people, but types. I mean, I think that maybe one or two of them managed to kind of break through from that, but it didn't feel lived in. It felt very much like surfacey, and in the worst kind of sitcom way that you wouldn't expect from Michael Schur, who's made a career out of kind of creating memorable characters on his sitcoms.
Well, I mean, I think you and I both probably know a little bit more than the average person about the mechanics of how comedy is put together. But I swear to God, I could see through to the pitch meeting and to the writer's room discussions and how this was sort of constructed. And it's kind of a flimsy scaffolding. You know, it felt like it's not, it didn't go that far beyond the pitch meeting.
Yeah, and you know, there is sort of an indication at the end that this could go on, that this could become we could have him in a different setting and kind of create do another season of kind of spy hijinks.
If it were spy hijinks, yes.
I would watch Ted Danson do another season of this in a different setting that wasn't so, you know, inherently sad. You know, I think that's kind of the problem with it, is that initially great premise, and then just really bogs down. You know, I I'm not surprised that Man on the Inside is number one on Netflix, because it does have that multi-generational big time appeal. And my daughters who love The Good Place, you know, will watch it because of Ted Danson, you know, and because it's Michael Schur. Like, they will watch it for that reason and muddle through it, probably.
It's no Hot Frosty, though. It does not star Lacey Chabert.
Well, Ted Danson is a bit of a hot frosty.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. It's true. All right. Maybe season two of A Man on the Inside will be Christmas themed. All right. Omar, thank you so much. I will talk to you soon.
Thank you, Neil.
All right. Thank you so much, Omar Gayaga. A Man on the Inside is currently streaming on Netflix. Also, thanks to Sherry Flanders for talking to me about Breath of Fire, which is currently streaming on Max, and to Richard Rushfield for stopping by the Pod Dome to kvetch about people being rude during movies, which is the one sacred space that we have left in our society. I guess maybe places of worship, but you know, to me, a movie theater is a place of worship. And don't mess with me when I'm in the movies. You'll regret it. And so will everyone who attends the movies with me. They will be embarrassed. I am Neil Pollack. I am the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We bring you hot, fresh content nearly every day, and we bring you this podcast nearly every week. Thank you so much for your time and attention, and I will talk to you soon.
Original production.